This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Klon Kitchen is a managing director at Beacon Global Strategies, which distributes Intelligence Matters, and he leads the firm's global technology policy practice. He is a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and has served as a national security advisor to former Senator Ben Sasse. Prior to his service in the Senate, Mr. Kitchen spent more than 15 years as an intelligence officer. Today, Klon and I will be talking about AI and national security. But first, here's my colleague, Michael Morrell, with a message about Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, Flare.io. That's Flare.io.
Welcome back. Klon, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Very happy to be here.
You know, of course, artificial intelligence, AI, is the topic today, and it's the issue that's consuming and concerning lots of people. But it's been around for a long time. So before we get into it, let's sort of set the historical stage. The quest for AI started back in the 1950, over 70 years ago, with a famous mathematician. The phrase computer scientist had not yet been coined, but that was Alan Turing. It took a decade more before MIT created a computer program for natural language processing between humans and computers. But by the 70s, interest and funding had waned, making the 70s the first so-called AI winter. The 80s brought renewed interest as the US and UK began funding AI again to compete with Japan. As I recall, expert systems, as they were known at the time, became all the rage in the mid-80s. But by the end of the decade, a second winter had set in. As the 2000s dawned, AI began to make advances again, and soon we heard names like Watson and Siri and Cortana and Alexa. And of course, last year, the spark that really lit off the most intense AI fire to date, ChatGPT. So that's how we got here. Let me ask you, Klon, why is generative AI getting everyone so excited?
Well, I think let me build on your point there a little bit, because I think that context will be helpful. So you mentioned expert systems. So the predominant way that we trained artificial intelligence in the early 2000s was this expert model of training. And what that means is you had to, by code, as an individual, train an algorithm to be an expert at whatever task you were assigning to it. So, for example, if you were building an algorithm to recognize images of cats, many people had to go in and actually code the individual things that make a cat a cat. Pink nose, pointy ears, stripy fur, that kind of thing. And you could imagine how difficult that would be in trying to account for all the nuances of what makes a cat, let alone making a distinction between a tabby cat and a Siamese cat, or even more, you know, a tiger and a tabby cat, right? And so those AI systems were limited because they were so resource and time intensive. In 2012, we had a confluence of three major developments that really helped us turn the corner on this. The first was we had begun to sufficiently digitize enough information to where we actually had large enough data stores to actually do something interesting with. The underlying computer science was the second thing. We had just advanced artificial intelligence as a computer science sufficiently to where we were able to start making some interesting progress, particularly in the context of what we call natural language processing, or computers understanding us as we speak naturally. And then the final thing was we started developing some tailored hardware, particularly graphic processing units, or GPUs, which are a type of semiconductor which are very efficient and very powerful. So around 2012, these three things collide, and that opens up a new way of training these models that we called machine learning. And so instead of going to an algorithm and trying to code it into being an expert on cats, what we did was we pointed these new algorithms at, say, a million pictures. And what an engineer did then was it simply said, this picture is a cat and this picture isn't a cat. This is a cat, this isn't a cat, so on and so forth, through that training deck. And the algorithm began to determine for itself the individual nuances of what made a cat a cat. And we found that these systems became much, much more powerful and much, much more effective at what they were trained to do. And so since 2012 until just recently, we've essentially been living off of that moment where we transitioned from the expert model to the machine learning model of training algorithms. And you've seen how powerful that has been. And what's happening now is we've grown in sophistication because of the continuing expansion of those three dynamics of data, hardware, and the underlying computer science, to where now we're pointing these new large language models and these what's called frontier models essentially at the internet and just saying, tell us what you've learned about cats, and they're performing. So it's this really interesting moment, and that's why you're beginning to see a lot of the excitement and opportunity, because in the same way that we saw whole industries and economies develop over the transition to machine learning, there's good reason to anticipate a similar type of impact, both from an efficiency and an economic increase, from this new wave of artificial intelligence.
So, Klein, yeah, this is really interesting. So, you know, given that this hot, cold AI pattern that I talked about, I think you touched on some of this. So why is this time different? And let me just expand on that a little. The famous sort of computer expansion, thinking about computers is, you know, Moore's law, you know, and that's a hardware thing, but that the number of transistors on an integrated circuit doubles every couple of years. And that gives you a pretty steep curve. If you were going to use something like that for AI, do you see that kind of a curve, or are we going to do one of these stepwise functions where we go up and then plateau for a while and then go up and then plateau? Is that a fair question?
It's a very fair question, and it's a very relevant question. I think the short answer is we don't know. I think things like Moore's law have been surprisingly resilient, frankly. We thought we would exhaust Moore's law, you know, a decade or two ago, and to some degree it continues to persist. It may in fact be the case that these new AI systems open up new scientific and engineering methodologies that would allow us to continue that, which would have a huge implication. So when we think about AI, you know, as I mentioned, so post-2012, we didn't meaningfully kind of advance the science, publicly at least, until, you know, this last year. But between 2012 and 2023 or 2022, it's not as though we had exhausted all of the really interesting and significant implications of the advancement that happened in 2012. And so I imagine that at the very least, we're probably facing that, where for the next decade or two, even if everything stopped right now, which I have no reason to believe it's going to, that there would be plenty of advancement of benefit and implication from the technology as it currently exists, that we would have plenty to do. Now, that being the case, I think if you look at just what's happened in the last year since ChatGPT went public, it's hard to argue that we're anywhere close to a stall. So we may advance, even let's say we only advance 2 more years. If you look at the rate of change over just the last year, we're still in a fundamentally different world 2 years from now than where we are right now. And so I think that's what everybody's trying to understand and wrap their brains around. We know the capabilities of these systems are significant. We have good reason to believe that as they continue to scale and evolve, that we're talking about exponential kinds of change, not just kind of step increases. But nobody really knows what that looks like. We none of us can really see around the corner properly. We have good reason to anticipate good things, but as I'm sure we'll talk about, we also have some real challenges that are becoming clear already, and anticipating those evolving at a similar rate. And so that, I think, accounts for a lot of both the hype and a lot of the concern that dominates the public conversation about these new versions of AI.
Yeah, that's great, Klon. So you just sort of touched on this, but you know, sometimes the science gets in front of the policy. But recently, the president signed out an executive order that deals with AI. So can we talk about that? What does it say, and why was it issued?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the Biden White House issued an executive order on the safe and trustworthy development of artificial intelligence. It is the longest executive order that's ever been issued. It's over 111 pages. And I think it can be understood as having two primary objectives. The first objective is the White House looking at the rest of the executive branch and saying, how do you intend to deploy and use these advanced artificial intelligence systems, particularly large language models? I think there's a recognition that these could hold great promise for efficient and effective governance, that they could help prevent and even identify waste, fraud, and abuse, and it could just generally make the government work better. And so the White House has looked at the executive branch and said, we need a report back from you explaining to us how you intend to use these systems. And as you do this, here are some guardrails that we want you to be aware of as you think about that possible deployment. So if you're the Health and Human Services, we want you to be thinking about how you're going to protect individual user data or medical data. If you're in housing and urban development, we want to make sure that these AI systems don't inadvertently, you know, essentially reintroduce artificial intelligence-driven redlining so that underrepresented people groups are somehow marginalized or not being protected appropriately. And then obviously in the defense applications and national security-related applications, we want to make sure that we're not creating negative national security outcomes, which I'll talk about in a second. So that first major objective of the executive order is, hey, just tell us how you're planning on using this. The second objective is, and tell us how you're going to prevent the worst possible outcomes. How are you going to mitigate the attendant risks of artificial intelligence? And they give particular guardrails, but then they also task entities for understanding the national security concerns that might be provoked by these systems. And in that, they then kind of turn the gaze to industry and they say, if you are going to be developing what the government calls dual use artificial intelligence systems that meet a certain threshold of computational power or kind of implication, then you need to then take a series of steps to assure us, the government, that you are working diligently to identify those threats and to mitigate them. And then it tasks a series of departments and agencies for coming up with the standards by which those threats would be assessed and the best practices for industry and government to deploy in that kind of mission.
So daunting task, right?
Yeah.
Especially with a technology that is not yet well-defined. All right, so it's sort of a moving target. But in addition to the executive order, Klon, the 2024 National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, that was passed by both chambers of Congress, includes a provision directing the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, to create an Intelligence Community Innovation Unit, which will certainly have a heavy AI focus. The DNI's policy role in the intelligence community's use of AI also specifically called out in the NDAA. So given that and what you just said about the executive order, what do you think will be the key issues that the intelligence community will, the DNI will have to sort of tackle first?
So this is the DNI's expression or the intelligence community's expression of this broader requirement to figure out how it's going to use and defend against AI. The intelligence community, Andy, as you know, has huge opportunity with AI. I mean, great efficiency gains, the ability to know more than we've ever known before, the ability to automate some repetitive tasks and some kind of low-level analysis to support broader intelligence efforts and work. All kinds of good things that could come from it. But, you know, we got to start thinking about what that looks like and how we're actually going to do that. And so an innovation unit inside the intelligence community makes a lot of sense. The DoD has had a defense innovation unit now for several years. And I imagine that the intelligence version of that unit will face many of the challenges that the defense innovation unit has faced in that challenge. And it's going to be this, in some way, similar concerns that the IC's NQTEL has faced over the decades. And that is, they will likely become very good at technology scouting. They will find interesting tools. They will be able to go to industry and help industry understand specific uses that that the IC might have for a particular algorithm or AI capability or any advancing technology. And they'll build relationships. They'll build connective tissue between themselves and industry on those issues. And that'll be good. What they are likely to struggle with, as others have, is transitioning those good ideas and kind of proof of concept projects into programs of record. Like actually turning them into meaningfully integrated and adopted persistent programs that, you know, have the impact at the scale that I suspect that Congress is wanting with this new innovation unit. And not to belabor this kind of bureaucratic point, but one of the inherent challenges with these kinds of organizations within broader, bigger agencies and departments is that the traditional program officers and resource officers, they're not typically buying things or looking for things on the edge because they're dealing with requirements that are generated in much more pedestrian ways. Now, you'll have pockets of innovation within these agencies that have a little greater agility, but one of the challenges is we've largely dealt with the authorities issue, so we can buy essentially whatever we need to buy. We've largely dealt with that. But there are some persistent cultural challenges, and that comes with, you know, individual resource officers who don't understand AI. They've been buying traditional systems for, you know, a decade and a half, 2 decades, and so there's just some slow pickup. Now, I think we can get over all that, and I suspect that that will be one of the clear marching orders for the Intelligence Innovation Unit, but I imagine that that kind of same challenge will be something they have to deal with.
You know, that's a great point. You know, Klana, as I think about this and having spent a lot of time on the analytics side of the intelligence community, you know, I don't see how the intelligence community can go forward without AI, because the data that comes in is so vast and so complex that you sort of need this co-pilot to help you get through it. Of course, that implies there's a trust factor with the AI, that you begin to trust that it's good enough to get you looking at the things you need to be looking at, right? And I think that's a real key.
Yeah, so there's a number of implications. You know, as we deploy AI, and we're going to, because as you say, it's just too powerful and it offers too much of a necessary good for us to ignore it. But it will have some implications. So, for example, we're going to know more than we've ever known. If you talk to most analysts, the biggest problem they face is not too little information, but they're deluged with it, and they don't know how to use it all. So AI is definitely going to create an opportunity where we're going to know more than we've ever known. But with that, as these AI systems mature, we're not always going to know how we know it. And that is a persistent problem with advanced AI. It's what we call the black box problem. And that's because these systems are capable of dealing with volumes of information that no human ever could, and it is able to draw correlations and relationships between data that no human really would understand. And it's not always clear how it's doing things. We understand the inputs and we understand the outputs, and the outputs are verified, and it's like, okay, yeah, that's real, that's right. But we can't always explain what happened in the middle. And that's probably going to be something that we navigate for the foreseeable future, which then leads to your point about trustworthiness. I imagine that the initial objectives that we give to these systems are going to be things that they're really good at, like image recognition, you know, looking for tanks and satellite imagery and that kind of thing. And then even helping generate reports and that kind of stuff. I think that they'll be really good at that. And so these systems over the course of time will become very authoritative until they're not, until they miss something. And that's almost inevitable. So you can imagine when you open your phone and you use, you know, a map application, and you say, I want to go home. Typically, we don't interrogate what it says because we trust it, because it's gotten us home faster and safer than, you know, anything else. But one day when that app tries to drive you off a cliff, well, now you no longer trust it. And we're likely to move into a place where one of these systems, long proven and trusted, is going to miss something, because you always miss something. And if it's bad enough, we're going to have to make a decision about what our reliance on those systems looks like. We'll most likely respond by trying to build some type of technological redundancy. But these are the kinds of things that we're going to be facing as we integrate AI into the IC.
Yeah, you know, there's always, you're exactly right. There's always going to be a risk. And as long as it's a managed risk, right? But, you know, as we said before, I just don't know how you deal with the complexity today without something like this. But, you know, AI is not just about the government. It's also about the private sector and industry. And so, you know, what does this mean for, how should they think about AI? And what does it mean for them?
Well, many in the industry are thinking about many of the things that we've talked about. I think one thing that the executive order makes very clear is that we're all in the national security business now. So when it defined these dual use models that have to be kind of red teamed and engaged, it defines them very broadly. And it defines them as these models that, despite how they were intended to be deployed, if it's possible at all that some particular deployment or use could result in a national security threat or concern, then these systems need to be, you know, kind of pressure tested. Well, there's a lot of that, right? There aren't many AIs who aren't going to fall into that category. And I'll give the listeners an example. So ChatGPT and Google's Gemini and Microsoft Copilot and like all of these systems aren't just going to be these independent things that we go to on a web page. They're going to be deeply, deeply integrated across essentially everything. And one of the key deliverables in the near term is deploying these across business enterprises to help companies do all the things that we've been talking about in terms of gain efficiency and economic productivity and that kind of thing. Well, imagine that ABC Chemicals deploys a large language model to help it do research, to help it manage that research, to help do back-end office capabilities, that kind of thing. Well, there's a real concern, for example, that let's take a traditional cybersecurity threat of the insider threat. Well, what if a disgruntled employee gains inappropriate access to that deployed model and uses it to ask it questions about what a novel chemical weapon might look like? I mean, again, we're talking about a chemical company. And so that model could meaningfully produce something quite concerning if that's not actively mitigated. Or one of the things that we've learned with these large language models is this idea of what they call emergent capabilities. It's the idea that a model trained to do one thing somehow develops a capability to do another thing. And we don't always really know how they do that. So it was trained to do English to Spanish translation, but it taught itself calculus, right? So that actually happens. Well, in that case, imagine you and I would understand this, a foreign adversary who through cyber means gains access to a company's model and uses it for a nefarious purpose that it was never intended to do, but that it was capable of doing. Companies are going to have to think about that. What we don't know right now, what Congress hasn't figured out, is like, okay, what does liability look like there? What is the cybersecurity infrastructure requirements for managing something like that? Like, these are the types of conversations that we're now going to be having over the next 12 to 24 to 36 to 48 months, navigating all this. And industry is going to be right smack dab in the middle of all that, because this technology is not slowing down. We're going to continue to innovate faster than we can secure. But these are going to be bet the business challenges. And so companies are going to have to be ready for this.
So, Klein, you know, we just talked about how important AI is or will be for, you know, government, national security, and you just described private sector. And I guess you've convinced me that this time is different from past, you know, AI zeniths. You know, a few years ago, Vladimir Putin said the nation that leads in AI will be ruler of the world, sort of a very Russian construct there. But do you agree? Is this analogous to an arms race, or is it more nuanced than that?
I'm going to say yes to both. And what I mean by that is AI is it can be understood in multiple ways, and I think it's all of these. It is a novel technology unto itself. It is a general purpose technology, which is essentially going to influence every other technology. And it's kind of a battlefield. So what I mean by those things is, you know, obviously AI is a discrete capability and kind of area of science and engagement. And in that sense, it is very much a race between, you know, good guys and bad guys. And the good news there is that 3 years ago, I would have said it was a jump ball between us and China in terms of who was going to dominate this space. I think right now we actually have a real window of opportunity where we, with these large language models, because we are unquestionably the leader in the underlying science, and we're starting to gain greater control on the hardware side of things. So we've got a window, I think, where we can assert and even expand or extend our leadership in a way to where first mover advantage could be decisive for a long time. And so I'm eager to remind people that AI is not only a national security challenge, it is also, in my view, a national security lifeline for the United States. And so I think we need to pursue it as such. In terms of it being a key enabling capability or a general purpose technology, I mean, we already see this. We see this in terms of what it's going to do to the biomedical industry, what it's going to do to advanced manufacturing, what it's going to do to, I mean, companies up and down the value chain. It's essentially going to suffuse everything. And then when I talk about it being a battle space, we're going to see nations developing capabilities aimed explicitly at shaping and blunting the AI systems of other nations. We're going to build whole strategies around data manipulation and data poisoning. We're gonna come up with all kinds of just really complex approaches for predicting how foreign AI systems are going to be enabling our enemies. We're gonna have to think about how do we do AI interoperability with our closest partners and allies. And this is all just, you know, a category unto itself in terms of the type of thinking and engagement that's gonna be required. So AI is this thing that is really going to be complex. And again, though, while there are real distinct challenges, I'm generally optimistic because I see us having an opportunity to reassert our leadership.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Klein Kitchen.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
You know, one of the things that we've touched on here a couple times is a possibility AI could be used for evil. And as you know, a bunch of AI industry leaders made some voluntary commitments to the White House about how they would try to protect from that happening. And you mentioned that earlier. So just, I'm going to use some of the exact words that was in the agreements. And it says, to commit to internal and external red teaming of models or systems in areas including misuse, societal risks, and national security concerns. Now, as you touched on earlier, there's a special emphasis on biochemical and radiological risks in ways which can lower barriers to entry for weapons development. And of course, cyber capabilities and AI being used to find vulnerabilities. So let's just touch on the red teaming thing, since that was the key issue in all of the agreements here. And you know, Klein, that's a phrase that comes out of the Cold War. Today red teaming is part of a very large toolkit of what we call structured analytic techniques. And for our audience, these techniques and methods are used by intelligence analysts primarily to challenge accepted mindsets and look for alternative explanations for their data and their hypotheses. Red teaming is specifically intended to model how an adversary may think and act on a specific issue. It's a challenge analysis technique, and in my experience, when used, it can lead to some real heat because you are taking the opposite view or you're trying to attack someone's capabilities. So how do you think this technique could help the large language model developers live up to their White House commitments?
You have forgotten more about red teaming than I know, but I appreciate you asking me. I would say red teaming and other structured analytic techniques, or SATs, are going to be essential. The whole idea behind them is for developers to deliberately try to break their models and make them do something that they're not supposed to do. And the idea being that if you can do that in a safe environment, then you proactively identify a threat and then can begin to mitigate it so that other people in an unsafe environment can't. Right? That's the idea. Like, pretend to be the bad guy, try to do something truly awful, stop it so that other people can't actually do it. Well, as you mentioned, that often requires thinking outside of the constructs that shape and constrain a lot of analysis. Now, those guardrails that constrain what we'll call normal analysis are there for a reason, because of the purpose of that work. But when you're trying to be creative, you employ capabilities like red teaming. Now, the challenge with red teaming is, for it to really work, you have to have a really diverse set of expertise that is participating, because you have to have people who are coming at the problem from a completely different perspective, who aren't kind of burdened and laden down by the normal presuppositions. So for example, if you're working on something around weapons proliferation, you don't want to build your red team using only weapons proliferation experts. You want to bring in human trafficking experts. You want to bring in climate security experts. You want to bring in counterterrorism experts, right? You want to have, maybe you throw in an economics person who thinks in systems and has some insight to that. You want to have really creative people who feel the freedom to kind of push against the boundaries. You also, though, have to scope it in such a way as to where it doesn't just become the kind of dance of the good idea fairies, where people are just making up things that are kind of outlandish and not actually helpful. It has to have some connection to reality. And then on top of that, you need to kind of, typically you have to change over that talent with a type of frequency so that it's always fresh, because even red teams can become stale and bound to certain ideologies and methodologies. And so it's one of these things that is really important and valuable, but takes a level of sophistication to do. And I think as industry is asked to do this, one, it should include all of those structured analytic techniques, not just red teaming per se. But as it does red teaming, it's going to have to account for these realities. And I think, frankly, there is a lot that industry can learn from the intelligence community, because, as you know, we've been doing this for a long time and we're really, really good at it. And then the final thing I'll say there is that, you know, the example you gave is like a chemical weapon. Well, if you're red teaming a model on a chemical weapon, you're not just asking it, hey, tell me how to make a chemical weapon, right? You need an expert who understands the chemical compound. So actually, you know, how do you actually make the thing? But then you also need a different kind of expert who understands dispersal, right? Can this be aerosolized? Is it put in some type of a pellet form? You know, there's all kinds of interesting questions. And if you're really going to red team these models, there's a depth of expertise that industry is going to have to find and rely on that is not, number one, a deep expertise out in the public sector. And two, you know, they're going to need people who have access to those networks and kind of bring them to bear so that they sit alongside, you know, a group of engineers to really exercise these models the way I think the government and just the broader population is going to require.
You know, Klon, just a comment and a question. You know, you were talking about the diversity required for these red teams, and that's absolutely spot on. A number of years ago, a professor named Phil Tetlock wrote a book called Expert Political Judgment, which I'm sure you've run across. But in there, he appropriates a phrase from an ancient Greek play, and he uses it for a different purpose. But the phrase is, a fox knows many tricks, a hedgehog knows one big one. And he uses that to talk about people who are smart generalists, sort of being the foxes, and experts being the hedgehogs. And saying that, you know, if you just rely on the hedgehogs, you don't always get the right answer, you know, because they're steeped in their areas and some places you need them. But sometimes the generalists or the people who are, you know, smart generalists can really add to a picture. And so I think that's a great point on red teaming. But, you know, as we talked about earlier, AI is not static. It keeps changing and getting better. So this is what you're describing is not a one and done, right? I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but it seems like this has to be an ongoing process as newer, better, smarter versions of AI come out that may be able to get past some of the quote unquote guide rails that you may have put in previously. Is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. This is now going to become standard operating procedure. Right now, the way the executive order is written, a requirement to do red teaming only applies to large language model developers whose model meets a certain threshold. And I'm not aware of any existing model that actually meets that threshold at this moment. However, if I were just someone else in broader industry, I would not console myself with that and say, oh, okay, well, this is someone else's problem. Because, as you know, we're moving into a presidential cycle here next year. Let's say that an AI large language model is used to generate misinformation, and it gains sufficient traction that it becomes a political issue that we're now discussing in the context of a presidential election cycle. And let's say that the way it was done was that it was an accounting AI that a consulting firm had deployed, but that a foreign hostile agent gained access to and reoriented it to developing some type of persistent misinformation. So in that case, which is imminently feasible, you can imagine that the U.S. government is going to have questions for everybody up and down that value chain. They're going to want to talk to the people or the company who developed the underlying model, so the big company who built the thing, and said, hey, what guardrails did you put in place to prevent it from being used this way? And then if the accounting firm used some type of a technology integrator to help them deploy that, the government's going to go to that technology integrator and say, hey, what did you do to this model? I know you took the underlying base model from this company and you oriented it and optimized it for this application for your client. When you did that, what diligence did you do to ensure that you weren't introducing a national security concern? And then they're going to look at the endpoint company, that consulting company, and they're going to say, when you deployed this and you made it available to your clients, what diligence did you do? Was there any testing at all? Did you have any sense that it could be misappropriated this way? And it will not be a sufficient answer for everybody to say, oh, well, we thought that was their problem. We didn't know we had to do that. Your executive order doesn't task me with doing that because I don't have this model of a certain size. And I don't think that's going to work. I think even if you have a kind of a technical legal point, maybe you do, maybe you don't, the sheer reputational risk of being the locus of something like that could take you down. And I think the only answer back to those questions is it can't be perfection because nobody's going to be perfect. But I think the only viable response back is, okay, U.S. government, something clearly went sideways here, but let me show you the good faith due diligence that I engaged in. I brought in a series of experts to help me exercise this model the best we knew how. We've done a series of ongoing red teaming engagements with the model. We required that the vendor that we used to deploy this did something similar, and they required that the developer had something else. And I think that's kind of the White House's strategy, is it's by kind of putting pressure and turning screws on industry to, without directly tasking everyone to do everything, but by making a clear expectation known that this type of rigor is going to be the expectation, they want this idea to kind of proliferate through industry. Some will be early adopters, and I think those are the companies who are going to be, frankly, the safest. Others will take a more wait-and-see approach. Well, let's see what NIST comes up with in terms of standards and best practices, and, you know, maybe, frankly, maybe some other company will mess up and we'll learn from that. And then there will be some who I won't come to this until they're dragged kicking and screaming because they think it's too expensive, they don't think it really applies to them, and it will only be at the moment when they put the fear of God into them because they see one of their competitors or someone else in their industry get taken down by something like this. So I think that's what we're heading for. People disagree, but that to me seems eminently clear. And so the recommendations that I would give to anyone is to be as forward-leaning on this as possible within reason, and to make an informed business case for whichever posture you're going to adopt. And that likely means doing some type of an AI risk assessment that helps you understand the general risks associated with your industry, but then the risks associated with your specific company. And you're going to need people, and you know, Beacon and others do this, and this is the kind of stuff that that I think everybody's just going to have to start doing if they want to thrive in the economy that's going to emerge.
Klon, thanks. That was a fascinating discussion. I think one thing we can agree on is that it's going to be both exciting and challenging, and we're going to have to be nimble and sort of think on our feet as we sort of get into what really is uncharted territory. So maybe we can visit again as things change, which happens quickly. But thanks for joining us today on Intelligence Matters.
It's my pleasure. It's always great to talk to you, Andy.
That was Klon Kitchen. I'm Andy Macritas. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.